You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Aspen Daily News. My name is Greg Stewart. ARC upgrades could cost $3.25 million more than expected. New analysis found worsening conditions. Article by Lucy Peterson from the Tuesday, February 10 edition of Aspen Daily News Online. Upgrades planned for the Aspen Recreation Center could cost up to $3.25 million more than initially expected. The City of Aspen is planning several major upgrades to ARC facilities this year, many of which have not been updated since the building was first constructed 23 years ago. The City is planning to replaster the lap pool, remove and replace pool drains, update the pool's ozone and chlorine system controls, and replace the ARC's boiler. The Aspen City Council approved $1.83 million in contracts in November for the upgrades. But after securing the contracts, further analysis of the proposed upgrades determined that, quote, structural aspects of the original construction must be corrected in order to successfully complete the necessary repairs to the drainage infrastructure and concrete deck replacement identified in the original scope of work. An informational memo sent to council members states, a majority of the work is replacing aging infrastructure. According to the memo, there is considerable earth settling under the concrete decks around the swimming pools, which has damaged the pool and deck drainage infrastructure. In some cases, there is stagnant water inside pipes due to changes in slope and other conditions, a problem that will continue to get worse as time progresses. The new analysis looked at original construction documents, original construction process photos, ground-penetrating radar technology, interviews with facilities staff, and core drilling in multiple locations inside the ARC natatorium. The original scope of work did not include saw cutting and removing a top portion of the entire lap pool shell to create a structurally sound pool perimeter for correctly functioning deck drains and structurally sound swim blocks and diving board anchoring, according to the memo. It also didn't include an 8-foot depth removal and replacement of fill material to mitigate structural deficiencies in some areas of the natatorium. In summary, the complexity of the project and associated logistics to complete have expanded with greater study and analysis to ensure current problems do not reoccur in the future, the memo says. The team has taken an approach of cannot fail again, and addresses root cause of problems as opposed to simply repairing compromised infrastructure. The new discoveries could increase the cost by about $3.25 million, including contingencies, according to the memo. City staff identified a, quote, potential supplement funding scenario to use money from the city's parks fund to meet the updated costs. Council will review a plan with PNCI Construction that will reflect that cost during a March 24 meeting. In addition to the major infrastructure upgrades, the city also is planning to conduct electrical repairs at the ARC this year. Council approved an $887,669 contract with Pueblo-based Morton Electric, Inc. in January to replace electrical equipment in the building. The city will work with Morton Electric to replace the primary electric supply equipment serving the building in a phased manner this year so that the entire facility is not closed for a long period of time. The city hopes to conduct the electrical work in September. Most of the other major infrastructure projects are set to take place from early April through mid-June. The city wants to complete that work without having to close the entire building. The associated photo from page 4 features the Aspen Recreation Center, photo courtesy of the Aspen Daily News File. The photograph from page 1 is entitled Blue Bird, but not a blue bird. A great blue heron, standing in the grass while seeking sustenance near the Roaring Fork Conservancy last Thursday afternoon. Photo courtesy of Jason Charmer, the Aspen Daily News. Advertising from page 1 is for Susan Plummer and Christie's International Real Estate. Unobstructed views, ski in and ski out. It's Electric Pass Lodge, number 404 at Base Village. It features two beds, two baths, 1,238 square feet, finest finishes, premier unit, fully upgraded, just reduced to $3,250,000. It's SusanPlummer.com of Christie's International Real Estate. Contact Susan Plummer, phone number 970-948-6786. Continuing with local headlines, Denver Post story links Epstein to Aspen. Research offers various details of Colorado connections. It's an Aspen Daily News staff report. A story published on Sunday by the Denver Post, What the Epstein Files Say About Colorado, makes mention of events involving Jeffrey Epstein, his associates and trips to Aspen, some involving young women. The 1,500-word story, cultivated by five staff members of the Post, follows a review of recently released Department of Justice files to get a sampling of Epstein's ties to the state, according to the story. The newspaper reviewed 1,518 documents, including emails, text messages, pictures, and court filings, the story says. Searching the documents is difficult for a number of reasons, including Epstein's voluminous misspellings and grammatical errors, the Post story says. The files are heavily redacted, making it difficult at times to understand who is communicating with whom and to paint a complete picture of a particular conversation. The story mentions, quote, an email exchange in 2013 between Bella Klein, one of Epstein's accounts, and two other people as they tried to determine who had been with Epstein in Aspen on April 15 of that year. One person replied, I did not go to Aspen. Hope this helps. But the other two people's names were redacted, and the purpose of the trip was never discussed. The article continues. The story notes that Epstein traveled to Aspen over the years and points out that a recently unsealed grand jury indictment filed in U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Florida over the abuse of 13 girls lists a July 4, 2004 flight from Aspen to Palm Beach, Florida as evidence in that case. The names of people with Epstein on that flight were redacted, the story says. To view the full story, visit denverpost.com/2026/02/08/Jeffrey-Epstein-Files-Colorado-Connections/. And now, a family's ode to the mysterious adventure of life. Artistic journey with the Fulton Brothers event is Friday. An article by George Hansen of the Aspen Daily News. Over the last 50 years, Travis Fulton has left an indelible legacy in the DNA of the art world of Aspen. He helped found Anderson Ranch Arts Center in Snowmass Village in 1969. In 1980, he and the late Nick DeWolf designed and built the first computerized dancing fountain, which remains an iconic downtown Aspen attraction to this day. On Friday, Fulton will present a retrospective of his life's work in the arts at the Wheeler Opera House, alongside the work of artists whose DNA he literally shares, his brothers Bob Fulton and Ron Fulton, That's R-A-W-N Fulton, and their father, Robert Fulton Jr. The free show, which is called An Artistic Journey with the Fulton Brothers, will run from 7:30 to 9 p.m. The presentation will feature film footage, still photography, and commentary tracing nearly 100 years of creative work by the Fulton family. An Artistic Journey accompanies the opening of Travis and Ron Fulton's Sculpture and Photography exhibition at Aspen Collective Gallery, where there will be a reception after the Wheeler event. Ron, again R-A-W-N, will present images from his recent photographic collage series, Mandalas, Bach and Buddhism, Visual Fugues, and Dream Palaces. The work draws on the symmetry of traditional mandalas and the structural logic of box figures. Combining a single photograph with mirrored iterations of itself to explore balance, rhythm, and meditative space, the Fulton family is famous for their creativity and ability to push the limits of what's possible, whether it's the flying car, the dancing fountain in Aspen, incredible films from around the world, or colorful mandalas. Their collective work never ceases to amaze, said DJ Watkins, curator and owner of Aspen Collective. Travis Fulton described his work as an effort to translate real-life experience into physical form. I'd like to share how the hourglass of experience and thought have transformed wood, water, stone, and light into stories, he told the Aspen Daily News. During the program, Fulton and longtime collaborator Peter Hutter, H-U-T-T-E-R, will present examples of their large-scale collaborative landscape projects from across the country. Ron Fulton spent most of his career as a filmmaker, covering an extensive range of topics from world population and the environment to drug addiction to the computer revolution to several films about artists and teachings of the Dalai Lama. In the 1990s and 2000s, Ron worked with John and Kate McBride of Aspen's Sopras Foundation on the World Population Film/Video Festival, which challenged high school and college students to create their own films on the four cardinal challenges of our time: population, consumption, environment, and sustainability. Bob Fulton, who lived in Aspen from the 1960s through the late 1980s, was widely regarded as one of the world's most inventive aerial cinematographers, known for flying and filming solo with wing-mounted cameras. Fulton's work blended philosophical reflection with stunning imagery of natural landscapes, samples of which will be shown at Friday's show. His films have appeared in major commercial and broadcast projects, including work for the BBC. He earned an Emmy Award in 1997 for Denali, Alaska's Great Wilderness. He died in a private plane crash in 2002. His legacy continues through the Robert E. Fulton III Fellowship in Nonfiction Filmmaking at Harvard University. The brother's father, Robert E. Fulton Jr., was an inventor whose more than 70 patents included the Airphibian, the first flying car certified by U.S. aviation authorities, and the Skyhook aerial rescue system, later used by the military and popularized in films such as Thunderball and The Green Berets. His work as a filmmaker, photographer, and writer will be represented alongside that of his sons, proving that the A in the Fulton DNA stands for art. Together, the material that will be presented at the Wheeler reflects a shared family vision rooted in curiosity, experimentation, innovation, and a lifelong engagement with nature, philosophy, and art, underlined by a zestful love for life. As brothers, we have individually and collectively shared in an evolving artistic process our entire lives, Travis Fulton said. Ron Fulton punctuated the thought, saying, "Every film, every photograph, every sculpture, and every thought reflects this commitment to the exploration of what the world provides, how it has touched us, and how our work might continue to be of service." Robert Fulton Jr., captured the family's adventurous spirit when he wrote in his 1986 book, The Winds of Life, quote, "To the mysterious adventure of life, and all who share it, may your hearts stay young." A photograph from page 6 is entitled Derby Crash. It features a scene from Saturday night's Art Cart Alpine Rally, which was a test of speed and creativity. It reveals the difficulty of the city-sponsored event near the Aspen Recreation Center. Winners were announced Sunday. Most Creative Kid Art Cart Aspen Beavers Damn Good Cart by Nicholas and C.J. Kong, K-H-U-O-N-G. Most Creative Adult Cart, Beware of Bear by Smoking Pat and Flotato. Fastest Adult Art Cart, The Flying Drumstick by Sam Rose and Omar Rolf. And Fastest Kid Art Cart, Giant Gummy Bear Escape by Bond Bremen and Atlas Washington. The photo features onlookers to a crashed cart. Photo courtesy of Andy Curtis. The photo from page 3 features Bob, Robert Jr., Travis, and Ron Fulton as they make up the show An Artistic Journey with the Fulton Brothers. Photo courtesy of Travis Fulton. And now, advertising from page 3 for Real Estate on Higher Ground. It's Ridge number 28, featuring 2 bedrooms, 2 baths, 1,420 square feet, assigned carport parking, offered at $2,995,000, furnished, turnkey, a meticulously cared-for property which hasn't been made available for rent for years, finished in a mountain lodge style with high-quality finishes and fixtures throughout, including a burnished wood floor. This property feels brand new. Carefully placed aspens and evergreens block buildings you wouldn't want to see. Views of Sam's Knob and in the winter of Mount Daly as well from both the living room and the spacious deck. Ski locker located near Faraway Road with a very short walk. Ski access to and from Assay Hill. Open house Thursday, February 12 from 3 to 5 p.m. at 229 Faraway Road, number 28. It's the B.J. Adams team and Compass Real Estate. You can reach bj.adams@compass.com. Phone number 970-379-2114. Also at AspenSnowmassProperties.com. The ad features a spacious living room and hearth. And now, a look at News in Brief. BOCC District 2 seat draws 10 applicants. Pitkin County has received 10 eligible applications to temporarily fill the District 2 seat on the Board of County Commissioners, being vacated by Kelly McNicholas-Curry, who has less than 1 year left in her second term. Commissioners will appoint a resident of District 2 to the seat this month. The pool of candidates is Andorra Lysen, L-I-S-E-N, Ronay, R-O-N-A-Y, Megan Ruby, M-E-A-G-H-A-N, Ruby, Thomas Egan, E-G-A-N, Ted Mahon, Emily Kolbe, K-O-L-B-E, Scott Woolley, Chris Menges, M-E-N-G-E-S, Max Benhamou, that's B-E-N-H-A-M-O-O, Katie Frisch, and Charles Tarver. The deadline to apply was Monday at 5 p.m. The seat represents District 2, which includes part of Aspen's West End, Burlingame, and Cemetery Lane neighborhoods. County commissioners will discuss the interview process for applicants at today's work session. That would have been last Tuesday for listeners. They'll also talk about which priorities and topics might come up during the appointee's term, which will last about 10 months. McNicholas-Curry is resigning from the BOCC to become city manager of Montpelier, Vermont. Her last official meeting with the board will be on Wednesday, and her resignation will take effect on Monday. The remaining county commissioners will interview candidates at their February 17 work session. Then, the board will appoint someone to the District 2 seat through a resolution at subsequent meetings. The county's newest commissioner will take the oath of office on March 3. The current District 2 term ends on January 12 of 2027. If the appointee wants to stay in the seat beyond that date, they'll have to run in this year's county election. The county's elections website, PitkinVotes.com, doesn't list any candidates' filings for District 2 yet. Meanwhile, three candidates have already announced their intentions and filed paperwork to run for the District 1 seat, currently held by Patty Clapper, who is term limited. They are former Commissioner Bob Itner, former Aspen Mayor Torrey, and current Aspen Councilman John Doyle. Continuing with news in brief, Fishwit party already filled to the brim. Tuesday's celebration for the Freddie Fisher Irreverent Wit Prize in Aspen has maxed out on RSVPs and is now running a long wait list. If you haven't already signed up for the Jazz Party and Award Ceremony, which will be held at Paul JAS Center on East Cooper Avenue, a waitlist form is available through jazzaspensnowmass.com/events. The celebration starts at 6 p.m. Doors open an hour beforehand. Registered attendees should plan to arrive by 5:45 p.m. There will be an after-party at the Aspen Collective Art Gallery located at the Wheeler Opera House. Those who don't get into the main event may still celebrate elsewhere. Pitkin County Senior Services will host a lunch with music on Wednesday at 12:45 p.m. That would have been last Wednesday for our listeners. And Fishwit organizer Greg Pushman said another event is scheduled that evening at Marble Distilling Space in Carbondale. A winner has already been selected for this round of the prize. Compiled by correspondent Kaya Williams. And now advertising from page 4. Starting with Aspen Daily News. A Valentine that's cute as carnations. It features a tote bag with the words Aspen and the Downtown Aspen Community Grid. 10% off with Love ADN. That is Love ADN. Shop ADN.com. Now, it's Aspen Valley Eye Care. Welcoming Dr. Jennifer Windler. Now seeing patients in Aspen and the Willits Town Center. A highly trained, compassionate new optometrist joining Dr. Haju, bringing Boston-level clinical experience to the Roaring Fork Valley. Formerly with the Boston VA Medical Center, Dr. Jen brings advanced training in comprehensive eye exams, ocular disease management, eye emergencies, eyeglasses and contacts, LASIK and cataract surgery co-managed care in Aspen at 525 East Cooper Avenue, in Aspen at 81611, and the Willits Town Center at 850 East Valley Road, Basalt, 81621. Call today to schedule. Phone number 970-236-9252. And now advertising from page 5. I can't believe it. Look at the low rates. Cunningham Mortgage, Mac Cunningham President, Mac at CunninghamCompanies.com. Phone number 970-379-9333. And now a notice from the Resnick Center for Herbert Baer Studies, Sculpting the Environment, the three-dimensional art of Herbert Baer, now open Tuesday through Saturday 12 to 5 at 610 Gillespie Avenue at the Aspen Institute campus. It's free to the public. Phone number 970-544-7899. The ad features a yellow modernist sculpture. And now a notice from the town of Basalt. Bring your creativity to Basalt's Sunday Market. Vendor applications for the 2026 Basalt Sunday Market season are now being accepted through Friday, March 13, 2026 at 5 p.m. Vendors will be notified by Friday, April 3 of 2026. Learn more and apply at basalt.net/Sunday Market. And now, from Western Regional News, San Francisco teachers strike over wages and health benefits. Article by Olga R. Rodriguez of the AP. About 6,000 public school teachers in San Francisco went on strike Monday, the city's first such walkout in nearly 50 years. The strike comes after teachers and the district failed to reach an agreement over higher wages, health benefits, and more resources for students with special needs. The San Francisco Unified School District closed all 120 of its schools and said it would offer independent study to some of its 50,000 students. We will continue to stand together until we win the schools our students deserve and the contracts our members deserve. Cassandra Curiel, president of the United Educators of San Francisco, said at a Monday morning news conference, teachers with a union were joining the picket line after last-ditch negotiations over the weekend failed to reach a new contract. Mayor Daniel Lurie, L-U-R-I-E, and Democratic U.S. Representative Nancy Pelosi of San Francisco had urged the two sides to keep talking rather than shut down schools. Union members planned a Monday afternoon rally at San Francisco City Hall. Negotiations were scheduled to resume around midday. Schools will remain closed Tuesday, the district announced. We look forward to receiving the union's counteroffer, said San Francisco Unified School District Superintendent Maria Sue, SU. She told reporters on Monday that the district had put forward a comprehensive package despite entrenched financial difficulties. This is a viable offer. It is an offer that we can afford, Sue said. We will be at the table and we will stay for as long as it takes to get a full agreement. I do not want a prolonged strike. Teachers cite cost of living, staffing shortages. Lily Perales, P-E-R-A-L-E-S, a history teacher at Mission High School, said many union members can't afford to live in San Francisco anymore. Too many of my colleagues have been pushed out of the city because of the high cost of living, and with our current contract, it's not enough, she said from a picket line Monday. We're willing to be on strike until all of our demands are met. Her colleague, Aaron Hart, a photography and media arts teacher at Mission High, said schools are understaffed. That's why we're out here. We just really want stability for our students, he said. The union and the district have been negotiating for nearly a year, with teachers demanding fully funded family health care, salary raises, and the filling of vacant positions impacting special education and services. The teachers also want the district to enact policies to support homeless and immigrant students and families. The union is asking for a 9% raise over 2 years, which would mean an additional $92 million per year for the district. They say that money could come from reserve funds that could be directed back to classrooms and school sites. SFUSD, which faces a $100 million deficit and is under state oversight because of a long-standing financial crisis, rejected the idea. Officials countered with a 6% wage increase paid over 3 years. Sue said the offer also includes bonuses for all employees if there is a surplus by the 2027-28 school year. A report by a neutral fact-finding panel released last week recommended a compromise of a 6% increase over 2 years, largely siding with the district's arguments that it is financially constrained. The union said San Francisco teachers receive some of the lowest contributions to their health care costs in the Bay Area, pushing many to leave. Sue said the district offered two options. The district paying 75% of family health coverage to the insurance provider Kaiser, or offering an annual allowance of $24,000 for teachers to choose their health care plan. Lurie, who helped broker an agreement that ended a hotel workers' union strike after he was elected and before taking office, said that the city agencies were coordinating with the district on how to offer support to children and their families. The associated photo from page 7 features math teacher Mar Martinez as she joins teachers and San Francisco Unified School District staff as they partake in a citywide protest to demand a fair contract while at Mission High School on Monday in San Francisco. photo courtesy of Bronte Whitpen / San Francisco Chronicle via AP. And now, advertising from page 7. It's for Snowmass, Mardi Gras, and Chinese New Year celebration. Tuesday, February 17, at Snowmass Mall and Base Village. Bead toss, dragon dance, hi-fi concert, and more. It's free. Find more fun at gosnowmass.com. And now, a notice for the Healthy Community Fund of Pitkin County. By the community, for the community. We are making our community safer by helping people resolve their crises. Civil legal matters that involve our safety, our homes, and our children need to be resolved fairly and efficiently so people can have faith in our system of justice and get back to living their life. The voter-supported Healthy Community Fund assists the Pitkin County community by providing grants to nonprofit organizations that provide critical health and human services and community resources. Learn more at pitkincounty.com/HCF. Continuing with Western Regional News, from page 8, trial against Meta in New Mexico focuses on dangers of child sexual exploitation on social media. Article by Morgan Lee of the AP. A trial focused on the dangers of child sexual exploitation on social media and whether Meta misrepresented the safety of its platforms began Monday in New Mexico with opening statements. It's the first standalone trial from state prosecutors in a stream of lawsuits against major social media companies, including Meta, over harmed children, and one that is likely to highlight explicit online content and its effects. Prosecutors told a jury that Meta failed to disclose what it knew about harmful effects of its platform on children in violation of state consumer protection laws. Meta also is accused of creating a public nuisance. Quote, "The theme throughout this trial is going to be that Meta put profits over safety," attorney Donald Migliori represented the state of New Mexico in its suit against Meta. Meta clearly knew that youth safety was not its corporate priority, that youth safety was less important than growth and engagement. Migliori and jurors will hear testimony and see internal communications from CEO Mark Zuckerberg and head of Instagram Adam Mosseri that illustrate Meta's emphasis on profits over safety. He said internal Meta communications also show that Zuckerberg knew of widespread use of the platform by children under 13, contradicting public statements. The actions of these two individuals demonstrate their prioritization of growth and engagement over safety, said Migliori. Testimony is expected to be drawn from current and former employees of Meta, with safety responsibilities to show that Meta misrepresented what it knew about the effects its platforms on teenagers and preteens. Whistleblowers on the state's witness list include Arturo Bejar, B-E-J-A-R, an engineer director at Facebook from 2009 to 2015, who later testified to Congress about his daughter confronting harassment on Instagram. Migliori said prosecutors will also delve into what Meta knew about the addictive nature of its algorithms that decide which content to present to users. Prosecutors say they'll present evidence that Meta knew about 500,000 inappropriate interactions with children that took place each day on its platforms, while its ability to track those interactions was inadequate. Meanwhile, in California, opening statements began Monday in a separate case against Meta and Google YouTube, alleging that their platforms deliberately addict and harm children. Plaintiffs' arguments there and in New Mexico, if successful, could sidestep the company's First Amendment shield and Section 230, which protects tech companies from liability for material posted on their platforms, and determine how thousands of similar lawsuits will play out. New Mexico Attorney General Raul Torres sued Meta in 2023 and attended Monday's trial opening. His team built the case by posting as kids through social media accounts, then documenting the arrival of sexual solicitations, as well as the response by Meta, the owner of Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp. Prosecutors say they'll provide evidence and testimony that Meta's algorithms and account features not only enticed and addicted young people to social media, but also fostered a breeding ground for predators who target children for sexual exploitation. Meta denies any legal violations and says prosecutors are cherry-picking evidence to make sensationalist arguments. On Sunday, Meta called the state's investigation ethically compromised in its use of child photos on proxy accounts, delays in reporting child sexual abuse material, and the disposal of data from devices used in the investigation. In social media posts on X by company spokesperson Andy Stone, the company says lawsuits are attempting to place the blame for teen mental health struggles on social media companies in a way that oversimplifies matters. Meta says it has a long-standing commitment to supporting young people, highlighting a steady addition of account settings and tools, including safety measures that give teens more information about the person they're chatting with and content restrictions based on PG-13 movie ratings. For over a decade, we've listened to parents, worked with experts and law enforcement, and conducted in-depth research to understand the issues that matter most, the company said in a statement. We're proud of the progress we've made. The associated photo from page 8 features Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg as he speaks during an event at the Biohub Imaging Institute in Redwood City, California, November 5, 2025. Photo courtesy of AP Photo / Jeff G. File. And now, advertising from page 8. For Snowmass, it's the infamous uphill race returns at Mother Ascension's Fat Tuesday, February 17, 2026. Find more fun at gosnowmass.com. Over $1,500 of awesome draw prizes. Registration fee is $60. $30 of every entry fee goes to support the Aspen Hope Center. It's snowfusion.com. And now a notice from page 8. Winter Bike to Work Day. It's February 13, 2026. Once again, the Winter Bike to Work Day is February 13 in Aspen at Pepke Park, 7:30 to 9:30 a.m. There's food and giveaways and great raffle prizes. DriveLess.net. Phone number 970-920-5042. It's BikeToWorkDay.co. Brought to you by the City of Aspen Transportation. Continuing now with Western Regional News, armchair detectives flood social media as search for Savannah Guthrie's missing mom continues. Article by Hallie Golden of the AP. Moments after the news broke about the apparent abduction of today's show host Savannah Guthrie's mother, the floodgates opened on social media. Influencers relayed the timeline from the hours after Nancy Guthrie was last seen and posted photos of the blood found on her front porch that later was a match for the 84-year-old grandmother. Others called out individuals connected to the case as looking sus, that's for suspect, or filmed themselves walking through her neighborhood to help find her. The desperate search for Guthrie, who authorities believe was taken a week ago against her will from her home just outside Tucson, Arizona, has become the latest investigation to pique The widespread interest of online armchair detectives. As the search continues with no suspects or persons of interest, posts across Instagram, TikTok, X, Facebook, and YouTube have put millions of eyeballs on tips and theories surrounding her disappearance. But they've also helped to amplify rumors and forced law enforcement to repeatedly set the record straight on at least one crucial detail. Michael Alcazar, adjunct professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and retired New York Police Department detective, said overall the positives outweigh the negatives when it comes to the onslaught of social media posts. More people are aware. It keeps people alert, he said. If they know she hasn't been found yet, perhaps people will remember that, and if they see something, they might say something. He compared it to the widespread online response to the disappearance and death of Gabby Petito in 2021 and the impact that may have had on her body being found. Two YouTubers said at the time that an image they posted showed Petito and her boyfriend's white van and that it led investigators to the area where her body was found. But the FBI didn't specify what led to the discovery. I think it's just something that we have to adapt to as far as law enforcement. Alcazar said the true crime community is growing. There's a lot of people out there that want to help. But with the widespread posts also comes the proliferation of misinformation. Ashley Banfield, a contributor to the cable network News Nation, announced on her podcast Monday that a law enforcement source told her a Guthrie family member is the prime suspect. She seemed to quickly walk back the statements seconds later, saying the person, quote, may be a prime suspect, and adding that family members are often looked at first. The information quickly took off across social media, with people posting photos of the person she named. Pima County Sheriff's Chris Nanos addressed the rumor early in a news conference Thursday, saying authorities don't have any suspects or persons of interest. That remained the case Friday. I plead with you to be careful of what it is we put out there. You could actually be doing some damage to the case. You could do some damage to the individual, too, he said later in the news conference. Social media's kind of an ugly word sometimes. Other posts have included a medium expressing her feeling that Guthrie is close by and a woman using astrology to point her viewers in the direction of what may have happened. Kelvin Krustie, C-H-R-U-S-T-I-E, who has more than 3 decades of experience in negotiations for kidnapping, ransom, and extortions, said if the public truly understood the toll those situations can have on family and law enforcement, they might not hastily post unsubstantiated information. This stuff on X and other stuff out there that's pure speculation is actually making it more difficult for the families and making it more difficult to the police to secure the safe return of the hostage, he said. Julie Urquhart, that's U-R-Q-U-H-A-R-T, an elementary school teacher in New Brunswick, Canada, has been posting about the case on TikTok, Instagram, and Facebook. She said she was drawn to the disappearance because she has a mother near Guthrie's age and was fascinated that someone could have taken her seemingly without a trace. Urquhart said her information comes from national news sites and law enforcement news conferences. One of her posts on TikTok and Instagram amassed more than 4 million views, she said. That's 4 million eyes that now saw the story and now maybe will see something or know someone who does, she said. There's just so many people it hits. An image provided by the Pima County Sheriff's Department on February 2 shows a missing person alert for Nancy Guthrie. The notice alert, courtesy of Pima County Sheriff's Department via AP file. Also from page 9 is an advertisement for the 57th Annual Winter Sale by the Pitkin County Dry Goods. It begins Wednesday at 40% off. Open 11 to 6. The address for Pitkin County Dry Goods, 520 East Cooper Avenue in Aspen. Phone number 970-925-1681. And now commentary by Roger Marolt. Aspen is now a private island. I can't help wondering what Aspen has in common with the places where Jeffrey Epstein lived, visited, and sexually abused minors. All these places appear more alike than different. It makes it hard to say that what happened there could never happen here. Epstein's sexual exploitation scheme was large. More than 130 women and girls have already received compensatory settlements out of a $120 million fund set up for victims with credible claims of childhood sexual abuse by Epstein and his chief recruiter, Ghislaine Maxwell. These operations were allegedly carried out on his private Caribbean island and in his homes in New York, New Mexico, and Florida. He used a private Boeing 727 jet named Lolita Express to transport guests and abused minors to and from these locations. As reported on Sunday by Noel Phillips in the Denver Post, a grand jury indictment filed in the U.S. District Court in South Florida cites as evidence a July 4, 2004 flight from Aspen to Palm Beach as evidence in a case involving 13 girls. Jeffrey Epstein's cesspool on his fantasy island of lecherous rape and emboldened debauchery had for years been overflowing through enclaves of the world's richest and most famous. Many of those who moved through Epstein's circle now claim ignorance, despite the scale and duration of his crimes. They are not denying that any of this happened. They only say they had nothing to do with it and were completely unaware. Yet, the truth remains that young girls were serially abused in this widespread web of evil. It's an underlined and not subtle reminder to be careful about who you associate with. At this point, there's no way of knowing how many rich and famous people knew of Epstein's sexual crimes and who also frequently visited Aspen or own homes here. One thing we know is that Epstein took pride in courting the wealthy elite into his circle of friends. Today's Aspen also entices the same demographics, inasmuch there certainly exists the potential for overlap. I had the distinct displeasure a couple of years ago of meeting one of the infamous Alexander brothers at a party for the launch of their new real estate office in Aspen. It was Oren Alexander. My first impression was not favorable. He gushed about how great Aspen had become in the eyes of the world's billionaires, with every international luxury brand represented downtown. He derisively joked about locals eating tavern food in Woody Creek. Shortly afterward, Tal, Oren, and Alon Alexander were indicted on separate federal sex charges for allegedly drugging, sexually assaulting, and raping women from 2008 through 2021. The details are as ugly as Epstein's. I mention the brothers here with a distinct knot in my stomach because the now infamous Epstein files allegedly contain witness testimony that all three Alexander brothers were present at some of Epstein's parties. As such, it is another circumstance that connects Epstein and criminal sexual exploitation to Aspen, however indirectly. I am not suggesting here that Aspen's streets are crowded with despicable creeps or that it was a significant hub of Epstein's activities. What I am getting at, though, is that it could have happened here and we would never know it. We just don't know our visitors in Aspen as well today as we once did. So many now fly in on private or charter jets, immediately retreat to second homes or penthouse suites designed for seclusion and entertain themselves in the plethora of private clubs and bodyguard-surveilled parties here. I wonder if this is the necessary trade-off to be anointed one of the most elite resorts in the world. And if so, is it worth it? There was a time not long ago when our guests loved to meet and hang out with locals. Many guests no longer believe this is a good reason to visit our once uniquely quaint town. They have little interest in getting to know us. There are no longer any hidden powder stashes. That is, powder stashes. There are no funky local hangouts they care to visit. There are no secret mountain lakes to sneak away to. There are no local characters they are interested in. Anything they need to know about Aspen can be discovered with virtual and real assistance. Perhaps these are the greatest signs of changing times for Aspen. Locals used to have all the secrets, and they were cherished. Now, it appears our elite visitors have all the secrets to keep, and we probably don't want to know them anyway. Roger can be contacted via email at roger@meraultllp.com. And now, opinion by Steve Skinner, a silly fellow who put Aspen on the map. In 1952, a force of nature came to Aspen. The force set the tone around town for 15 years with music, farce, words, deeds, and pranks that will never be topped. Thankfully, the legacy endures. If you can on Tuesday, get to the Paul JAS Center and then to the Aspen Collective Art Gallery to rub elbows with those in the know about the man with the nose, Freddie Fisher. The JAS Center event is free, but an RSVP was strongly suggested. As mentioned before, Fisher had a nose to end all noses. Ruddy, bulbous, expressive, prominent. It led the way to an unforgettable face that was all at once wise, skeptical, smart, silly, fun, amused, and curious. The man could have been a model with the stubby face, rumpled hair, and home-rolled cigarette butt in the corner of his mouth, which was missing teeth. It's amazing that Freddie lived as long as he did. He drove every day of life like it was stolen. He never made it in Aspen today. Rather, he'd never make it in Aspen today, and he probably wouldn't want to. He certainly wouldn't recognize the place. But Aspen had room when he came to town, and he was absorbed into the local fabric like an oil stain on the floor of the garage. Indelible. Before he got here, he led a ferocious band in the late 1930s and 40s. He was known as Colonel Corn of Dixieland. The Schnicket Fritz, silly fellow, band was insanely goofy and clever while maintaining musical rigor, polish, and professionalism. How good were they? I'm glad you asked. Those with no sense of humor, and I know who you are, would have hated him and his music, but he was too clever to care about that. He had a 2-year recording contract with Warner Brothers and made nearly 200 records and was featured in several big Hollywood films. He was a big fish in a big pond, but he gave all that up to move to Aspen, where he became a big fish in this small pond without even trying. He moved to Main Street and put out a shingle as Fisher the Fixer. His fix-it shop became a hub for people needing assistance, advice, conversation, or a few laughs. He wasn't afraid to try to fix anything, and once famously threw a small explosive down someone's furnace to fix it. He made a lot of trips to the dump, not to drop junk off, but to pick it up and bring it home, finding useful goodies everywhere he looked. He eventually put an ad in the paper encouraging people to skip the dump and bring their junk directly to his place. He wasn't afraid to get his hands dirty. I keep a copy of the book Fisher the Fixer, curated by Barbara Lewis and Sue Lum, featuring his collective letters, anecdotes, and photographs by my bedside. It's easy just to scan a few pages at a time and gape at the wonder of it all. Sue and Barbara did a lot to preserve Fisher's Aspen legacy, and you can even do a YouTube search for Schnickelfritz to see him in all his glory in Hollywood. A small group of dedicated locals led by Greg Porschman has kept the party going by hosting gatherings and tributes. The Spirit of Fisher returns tonight. That would have been last Tuesday for our listeners, where the coveted Fishwit Prize, a once annual award for a snappy Aspen bard, will be announced. Tomorrow, Wednesday, again last Wednesday for our listeners, there was a senior lunch and then a party in the evening at Marble Distilling, distilling in Carbondale. Fisher should be remembered for all of his talents. Yes, he was a formidable tinker, but he also could carve a few holes in a sweet potato and play music on it like a quacky clarinet. He held court for après-ski at Aspen Highlands and made the musical rounds at the local venues like the Hotel Jerome, Golden Horn, and Wheeler Opera House. He was a featured player in the Red Onion Jazz Babies. He sang saucy songs that made the women blush and laugh out loud. Aspen's history is speckled with many wonderful people creating grand and glorious places and organizations. Freddie Fisher came in at the ground level and lived life to the fullest. He found a place where there was room for the boldly outrageous. His legacy is not so much brick and mortar, but words and music and laughter that still fills these hills if you listen. Long live Freddie. Steve can be contacted via email at mukzuki@gmail.com. Thank you for joining us for Aspen Daily News. My name is Greg Stewart.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.